Welcome to Closing the Gap, an educational podcast on gender bias in medicine. I'm Amber Sobrario, founder of this podcast, an emergency medicine physician at the San Antonio Military Medical Center.
And I'm Laura Smiley, an emergency physician at Detroit Receiving Hospital. This podcast series is brought to you by our sponsors, Medical Center Emergency Services, a not-for-profit democratic emergency medicine group in Detroit, and Feminem.
The views expressed are those of the author and do not reflect the official views or policy of the Department of Defense or its components. Welcome back. In our last episode, we heard personal, real accounts of sexism and marginalization for women physicians from across the U.S. Their stories give voice to a real problem we still face in medicine today. We also broke down the data and summarized the deficits with experts Dr. Dara Cass and Dr. Esther Chu, and we learned that we still have a long way to go.
I am sad right now about how much time I spent in my career hitting these walls, really these ceilings that women hit at every stage of their career.
In his opinion, ER has a lot of action, and so it's more of a man's job, and that's why there are more men than women in ER.
But I just feel like I'm falling behind my male co-residents because I lack that buddy-buddy relationship. I feel like they're moving forward faster than me because the attendings are investing more in them.
Female medical students have reported by the time they graduate, about 50% of them have been exposed to harassment.
I don't know why you guys get offended. I mean, this other attending has been called a nurse and she's been here for 30 years. It's a compliment. If someone calls you a nurse, it's a compliment.
But I never got an answer as to why I was ever excluded from something I actually know a lot about. It appears that a man who knows less is still preferred over a woman who knows more, regardless of the topic.
Is it the process of promotion is so biased in some institutions that it's nearly impossible for a lot of women to get promoted? Yes.
The moment myself and my female senior sat down, he said, girls, first things first, let's stick to the facts and not get emotional about anything.
He then said, well, you're a woman. Maybe he'll listen to you better. You have more assets than I do.
All in all, the salary data is very compelling and it's very consistent that women are still behind for unexplained reasons that are likely to be due to bias.
On this episode, we want to continue our conversation with Dr. Cass and Dr. Chu. We'll explore why everyone has a stake in gender equality in the workforce. So let's get to the main issue. Why should we care? I know why I care as a woman, but why should men care? Are we working for equality just for equality's sake? Or will groups, academic departments, and even hospitals see a real benefit?
So I want to start with something, and I'll hand it off to Esther because she'll say things in a much smarter way than I will, but I'm going to say
that.
That's not true. It is. You're so much better at the data than I am. Like, we're the yin and a yang going, you know what I mean? And I'm going to set up the conversation, and then she'll fill it in with the data information, right? So we know that corporations that have diverse boards and diverse leaderships are more profitable, right? We know that diversity is not just good for people. It's not like be best, be ethical, be happy, be great. It's not that. I mean, it is. But it's profitable. Trying to get people to do something because it's the right thing when it's expensive for them in the moment is hard. We want them to do it because it's both the right thing and it's better for their business. We are training an army of physicians in medicine and then we're squeezing them out just when they're good at their job. That's crazy. Okay. Do you know what happens to the 57-year-old male attending who has back pain and has to go out for surgery or has a heart attack and he has to go out with no sick leave, no protected time, no expectation of how we're going to fill in the gap for his delayed absence? It's the same thing as maternity leave, except we know that one 9 months in advance. Who's going to work when that guy's out for his heart attack or back pain? It's going to be the female workforce that just graduated from residency. Chu?
Yeah, I remember when we first put together this best practices for the advance of women document, I remember a male mentor looked at it and said, oh, these are just kind of good for everybody. You know, so many of them had to do with just parents and sick leave and family responsibilities and just kind of making a better workplace. And sure, some of those traditionally have you know, related more to the way that women's lives played out, but there was no real reason for that. And actually things are changing so quickly. And so a lot of men ended up reading that document, just saying, this is really just about supporting regular people who have families and not pretending like they don't have families. the truth is, once you have worked in a system that has things like backup call, that actually acknowledges that healthcare employees are human, that sometimes they get sick, sometimes their family members get sick, sometimes things happen and you just cannot make it into work. Once you start acknowledging that, it feels so intuitive and so normal that you can't imagine not having it. I think honestly, some of these things that we're fighting so hard for, the minute we flip the switch and do them, we will not be able to imagine it the other way. I've stopped saying things like, this is only fair for women. I mean, that's true, but that's just one piece of it. It is fair for women, but it actually makes better workplaces for everybody. And we know that from data. And so I really think this is about but all workers in healthcare. And then more than that, because of what we do in this field, it's actually about our patients, because we want a strong, well-supported, fully engaged, productive workforce to take the best care of patients that we can. And so I would end with one piece of data, which was a recent study, a large Florida data set of patients who presented to the emergency department with MI. This was published in PNAS, the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. And this was a very large data set of MI patients in Florida hospitals. And they showed that when you brought more women into an emergency department, the survival for heart attack patients improved. And it didn't just improve for patients taken care of by women physicians. It improved for patients taken care of by male physicians. So you increase the presence of women in the workplace, and then it's better for the patients they care for. And it was just a really beautiful and elegant example of how diversity has so many dividends in unexpected ways. So we're not trying to impose a unilateral burden just so that everybody feels good. This is really about improving all the things that we care about in healthcare, including the quality of the care that we deliver and lives, literally lives saved.
So you both inspire so many women, myself and Laura included. So we wanted to find out, how do you became involved in these issues? Dr. Chu, I'll start with you. Why do you work on helping women close the gap in the workplace? And why do you think all the data and research out there matters?
Yeah, I would say there were a lot of little experiences that all played a small role in driving me to this issue and really latching on and wanting to do something about it. I'm a primary researcher, and that is in a addition to the very man's world that medicine is, the research world within medicine is very male. So I had a lot of these experiences of just walking into a room and being shocked how few women were there, and kind of making eye contact with the women in those room and being in that room and being like, whoa, you know, how do we speak up in a room that is like that? I am sad right now about how much time I spent in my career hitting these walls, really these ceilings that women hit at every stage of their career. I would hit these barriers. Like I'd kind of be feeling like I was cruising along in terms of my productivity and my achievements and kind of, you know, looking to my left and right and feeling like I'm doing well, you know, compared to my peers. And then I would just hit this barrier to progress. And every time that happened, whether it was sort of getting a leadership position I wanted, being considered for a leadership position, being told that I was capable of certain accomplishments or rewards, or going for a certain salary that my exact peer was also going for. I mean, I kept on hitting these challenging moments where it was harder for me than I thought. And I completely internalized it and thought it was my fault. So every time that happened, I was like, I suck much more than I thought that I did. I had a lot of cognitive dissonance because it didn't fit what I was seeing on my CV. And yet there was all this messaging that that somehow I was just not a good fit for those things. And then I became involved in some of these national groups of women. And when I finally met the other women who were having similar experiences, it started a seed in my brain that maybe it wasn't me. Maybe these are experiences common to all women. At least in part, it wasn't totally me. And then I started seeing this emerging data over the past 10 years that really supported the idea of a systematic bias against women that makes that can make achievement and reward very challenging. And so So I think it was just sort of like all those things, and then getting to my mid-career and looking back and being like, whew, that was rough. I mean, I'm pretty happy with how things turned out. However, it was really, really rough and discouraging. There were many times when I thought I might opt out and turn to a different career path. And I think I don't want women coming after me to have those experiences, not in the same way. And I certainly don't want them going through it thinking that it's them needlessly, when there is so much out there that we need to address to make sure that there is fairness and opportunity for women. So so that's how it all came together for me.
Dr. Cass, you organize and run several conferences like FIX, Revive, and speak nationally on this topic. You're a master network and promoter of women. How did you get started with this? And do you have any strategies to help us pull each other up as women?
So I think that, how did I get started? I mean, very similar to Esther. In fact, I think that we kind of fell into this at the same time because of each other, right? So one of the things I think is important to recognize in this work is none of us do this alone. So part of the reason that we are changing things, and part of the reason why the conferences that we run have been so successful, is there is nothing if this isn't a collective effort, right? And the problem with gender inequity historically has been that it has been an individual problem and an individual solutions, and that's why nothing has changed. And so much of what we do is together. It is productive. It is proactive. It is inclusive, right? And so that goes back to me and what I do well, which is I am somebody who brings people together, and I can mobilize people around topics that otherwise are taken for granted by groups. So the idea that we don't support doctors and lactation when we tell people to lactate is ridiculous, right? But nobody was doing anything about it, or certainly not on a systems level, or if they were doing it, they were solving it for themselves in their moment. And the minute that their breast milk dried up, they moved on to another issue. I haven't breastfed a baby in 6 years, yet I still advocate for lactation policies and lactation spaces across the board. And so I think the best strategy I would say to pull us up as a unit in medicine, but yes, as women, is to fight for the issues that don't affect you like they do. Because it's the people that are vulnerable in those moments that cannot advocate for themselves. Right? We don't want somebody who's 36 weeks pregnant to be advocating for no nights in the third trimester when they are at their wit's end, physically exhausted, not sleeping, in preterm labor. Like, yes, yes, yes. We want the other people and the women to do that. And we want the women who have already had their kids to remember what it was like back then and advocate for those policies, put them in place formally, make them neutral, make them not personal, make them nobody's favor, make them not punitive, nobody gets a penalty, and move forward together. So that would be the best strategy, I would say, is treat every problem like it's your own in a way that actually makes it buffer the responsibility from the person that it has to deal with.
What we're hearing is that fixing this problem not only feels right, it's good business. A more inclusive workplace leads to real financial benefits, retention and satisfaction of physicians of both genders, and most importantly, better patient care.
So let's dive deeper in some of the data on this topic. We are going to start with an editorial that was published in the Annals of Emergency Medicine in 2017. And it's a really good summary of exactly what we heard from Dr. Cass and Dr. Chu. It shows that the greater number of women in leadership positions correlated with a better financial performance of company. I'm talking 30% of women on the board directly correlated with a better performance.
Not only that, but a reputation for inclusion helps with retention and recruitment of talent of either gender. It's easy to make the argument that this will eventually lead to a stronger company overall and a better bottom line. This paper was born out of the ASEP Diversity Summit in 2016, and it goes on to address how ASEP has recognized that this is a problem within the ASEP organization as well. They don't just point out their weakness. ASEP has made moves to address these deficiencies.
I think the most exciting thing that's coming out of this is this creation of a clinical emergency data registry where they gather data on racial and gender differences in the delivery of care. And this data is going to show us how and where we can improve in this process.
Great stuff by ASEP on this issue. We'll be looking for more from them as the data registry grows. Hopefully, we'll all be able to apply some of these strategies at our own institutions. And I know we'll be hearing more from Dr. Cass and Dr. Chu on these issues.
the other thing I'll say before we go is that, you know, emergency medicine is absolutely setting the stage for this work across the House of Medicine in a really cool way. We are a lot of it's kind of the kind of people that we are. The most important thing about our workforce is our physician workforce, our female physician workforce, has a sense of identity and community that is hardly found in other specialties. That is what makes emergency medicine special.
So before we let you go, I just have to ask, how did you two meet and become this awesome team?
How do we meet? The answer is this. I remember, do you remember the first day we ever met in person? I do.
No, so I don't remember that. I remember when I heard you.
Yes, name. Esther was the outgoing president of AWEM, and I was at AWEM in certain things, and we had been on a bunch of conference calls, but never actually met in person. And we were at a hotel for a conference. It was probably SAM, but it probably might have been something else. And she literally looks to me, and there's another physician named Esther Chen, who's not Esther Chu, and I had met her a bunch of times. And I didn't know that there were two, a Chu and a Chen, to be completely honest. And they're both, they don't look that dissimilar. And they're the same age and they, that's like, true. Whatever. So it was like she comes up to me or she was sitting down and she says, I just want you to know I'm Esther Chu. And it probably took me 2 minutes to realize. I'm like, no, you're not, because I've met you. But then I realized I had met Esther Chen, and it was really, and then it was literally from that, you know, we're very different. But we have the same passion. And there aren't a lot of people, I don't think, that can work as fast or as diligently as I do.
And who have like an endless appetite for this topic, like endless. Every aspect of it. And I also, right. And I remember I first heard Dara's name because she was nominated for an AWAM award. So I read her CV and I read these amazing letters of recommendation. I was like, who is this amazing, intimidating person who is described as like fearless and efficient and hardworking? And I was just like, the entire awards process was very humbling. But I remember reading about Dara a long time before we actually met, and then trying to track down like your headshot and things from you. But
right,
but it was
and,
like,
and I think that the thing
we
that,
didn't
the
know
thing
this that, was going to happen.
No, I think the origin story of our relationship, I think, lends to other collaborations, which is that we have very different skill sets.
That's true.
We're equally passionate. We're equally excited about this work, and we have so much we want to do together. But we're honest about what the other one, like, you know, the talent the other one has, and we kind of hand off a lot. So if there's something that has to be done that I know she's better at, I give it right to her, and I say, this is in your wheelhouse. This is something that you're going to do in a way that I'm not going to do. And the same thing I think is true for me. And so what it's created is, the way I described it on a podcast I did recently was, it's kind of like a tornado, right? Because it has this perpetuation of really kind of gender equity advocacy, right? It's this continuous momentum around, I got this, you got this, we got this, let's find more people to bring on together. Let's make our raft bigger, right? It's about being the core nidus for a huge network of people doing this work and being the consistent force through that, so that everyone that comes in and out and does the work with us knows that we are here for good.
I again want to thank Dr. Esther Chu and Dr. Dara Kass for joining us today. Thank you for your hard work and advocacy on these issues. We look forward to hearing more from you both in the future.
And I want to say, just, we are both so thankful that you guys are doing this. You know, as people that have done this work for a while and also constantly are traveling and telling people about these issues, the idea that there is going to be a tangible and well thought out podcast that can actually walk these issues for people to listen to is inspiring. And I want to, from the both of us, I want to thank the both of you for doing this, because I think it's going to be kind of amazing.
I was just thinking that I feel like this moment is where we're handing the baton off to the next generation, because we're being pulled in so many directions, and actually we're moving more to national, very general healthcare work across specialties. And I think we have less and less time to just focus on emergency medicine. So I think you're going to be the rising force advocating for these issues in our specialty, and we'll be cheering you on.
Thank you for joining us today on Closing the Gap. And don't forget to check out our show notes and references at feminem.org/podcast. If you like what you hear today and you want to hear more, join us for future episodes.
Our next episode is the history and progress that we've made, where we're going to celebrate the badass women who paved the way for us in medicine and hear some firsthand accounts of their struggles and triumphs.
Special thanks to our sponsors,
Medical Center Emergency Services, an independent nonprofit EM group in Detroit, and Feminem.
I'm Amber Sobrario.
And I'm Laura Smiley. Please join us next time on Closing the Gap.